Thank you, Father. Just as the swallows return every spring to Capistrano, I've winged my way here to Minnesota. I'm very happy to be here with you again. I feel as if I may be the largest harbinger of spring in the area today. And it really is very nice. It's the third year in a row that I've come in the springtime to address you. And many of your faces are becoming very familiar to me. I remember no names anymore. That whole section of my brain is just shut down. Everything they tell you about losing your memory when you get older is true, and I remember no names, including my own. You know what it's like at the beginning of the new year when you're signing checks and you have to remember what the year is, and it's a new year, and now what year is it? Well, that's the way I am with my name now when I have to sign a check. So don't think you're special. I don't remember any names at all. But I do recognize the faces. Very happy to be back here again. And it is a rare privilege. Word reached me. I had actually flown out to Minneapolis on Saturday and talked to my housemate, who's another old retired traditional teacher. It's good to have company as you get older, so you don't get goofy alone. But he informed me that there was word from the good Father Ringrose at St. Athanasius in Vienna, Virginia, who is making a good recovery. Your prayers are appreciated. Father Ringrose has been my priest and confessor for 27 years now. It is a great mercy, a very special blessing to have him there as our priest at St. Athanasius. But also, let me say this to you. You cannot imagine what it means to be a soul trying to make his way through this world and have a good confessor, the same confessor for 27 years. It's been a remarkable blessing, and I get away with nothing now. So, and it's not so much Father is very kindly and Christ-like, it's that one doesn't want to go into the confessional with these same sins anymore. So one actually does improve, one works to improve, because one doesn't want to burden a good priest with having to hear all those things. So it's... But anyway, Father Ringrose apparently announced from the pulpit that the rumors that had floated briefly of the possibility of a new seminary in Virginia turned out to be true, and the appeal has been made, and we will see what happens. It's in God's hands. The times are tough economically, for good or ill, and it would be a major move. But the thought of being able to drive maybe 90 minutes to visit you instead of getting on an airplane would be quite wonderful. So we'll see what happens in any case. But I'm very happy to be here. The past 2 years when I've been here, I've spoken about comic works, the great comic novel Don Quixote, and then last year, three of Shakespeare's great comic plays. This year is very different. We're not doing comedy or anything like it. It's a very serious subject, and therefore appropriate for Lent. This is, a kind of Lenten reading, because what we're going to look at in Aeschylus's Oresteia is the first complete play we possess in the history of the theater. I've long loved the theater. I did much work in the theater. And this is the first complete play. Now, I'll explain that as we go along. It's the only Greek play we have that is complete, because all the Greek tragedies were basically trilogies. They were written as three-part dramas, each of them a single act, fairly long, longer than a one act we would be used to. But the entire play would comprise all three parts. For all the rest of the Greek plays, we have solo individual pieces of what were once trilogies. The others are lost. I'll say more about that later. So we have individual plays. If you will, we have one-third of trilogies where the other two-thirds are lost to us. But this is a play where we have all three parts. That's why I call it the first complete play that we have, and one that is still produced. that is still done, is recognized as one of the great masterpieces in the history of the theater, in all of world literature. And it is particularly interesting that this play is the one that was permitted or allowed or providentially the play that survived, because it is about the birth of civilization itself. Now, this comes from the classical line of studies. The religious line, of course, is something different, but as we know, those two streams were essential in building civilization. From the classical world, much of what we take for granted or took for granted in the civilized world came from that greatness that was in the Greeks, that was passed on to the Romans. They added something different that was very much their own, and that whole strain of civilization that went forward. This is the play about the founding of civilization, the movement away from savagery towards civilization. And curiously, this is the one play, the one complete play from the Greek theater that was allowed to survive. So we'll say more about that later. It's a very great work. I'm not going to spend much time. It's an interesting question, and it should be discussed on a regular basis, because there are many good Catholics who don't understand this, and that is the question: why as Catholics do we study the classics, the classical literature from Greece and many of the Roman writers? Why do we do this? I will just give a very quick and simple answer. The first one I've already mentioned, which is, in terms of Western civilization, which is our birthright and our glory, one of the two streams that flowed together was from that classical world. If we're going to know what Western civilization was about, if we're going to understand what was used by many of the greatest of the Christian thinkers, of the greatest saints, it was merged with what had come from that great tradition, the classical tradition, and became part of the civilized order. I will turn, as witness to that statement, to the great St. Thomas Aquinas himself. You're studying here at the seminary named for him. And it was a great and good thing, because the debate had gone on for a while about, should the classical authors be read? Should they be studied? When he writes the Summa, and refers consistently throughout the Summa to the philosopher, we know he's referring to Aristotle. And what he did in doing that was, if you will, put his imprimatur on the study of the classics. And what he was saying was that those classical writers have much to offer, they should be studied, and there are things we can learn from them. The immediate beneficiary of St. Thomas making that step, and obviously, as you go through the Summa, it's very clear, his immense admiration for Aristotle and what Aristotle accomplished, but the immediate beneficiary was Dante. And because Aquinas had, if you will, to a degree settled that issue, Dante had open to him the entire world of the classics that he could use in writing the Divine Comedy. And that's the reason why, for example, in the Inferno, we find that terrifying vision of hell populated with classical mythical creatures. If he had been trying to write some centuries before, he probably wouldn't have been bold enough to do that. So the issue was settled, and Dante could use all of that classical tradition, could use many of those myths, could use what had come from the classical world, and use that as part of his magnificent Catholic poem, explaining in detail and in poetic glory what the Catholic faith is about. It's a perfect place where we see how the classics, again, were used. So many of those great figures from the Catholic past decided that the classical authors were worth studying and worth getting to know. Let me add one other thing, just to a very simple statement, if you will. It was an astonishing flowering that went on there in Athens from maybe about 500 BC, up until the time I believe that Aristotle was still writing into the 300s BC, it came to an end very quickly because of ill-advised wars, a loss of their own sense of self, questioning everything. There are any number of reasons. It's an interesting subject in itself, but it was a brief period of time. It was really a brief period of time, but a glorious period of time. And what characterized the greatest of the writers was that they were seeking truth. They did not have divine revelation, but they had been given human reason, and they came to understand that truth did exist, it could be discovered, and it was objective and outside the self. Truth was out there, unlike poor modern man who has become convinced that all truth is inside his own head. What these great writers knew was that there was truth, it was objective, it was out there, it could be discovered, and so they went on a search for truth. And the truths they discovered and put down are astonishing truths that we can still learn from. They have much to teach us. Because truth is truth where it is found and told to us by a truth teller. God's truth is one. So they did this extraordinary work. And part of what I'm going to be looking at as I talk about the Oresteia is the way in which much of what we now take for granted, having been given to it through revelation, God be praised, he gave us what we needed to know. They, in their small and tentative way, trying to work their way towards the truth, came to some astonishing conclusions and some astonishing insights that point toward things we have received through revelation and we know now to be absolute truth because God himself has revealed it to us. It was a great gift, I think, he gave to these men. There was something good in them as they went seeking. And as a result, they found things, and we should be familiar with them. Now, all that sounds very serious. The fact of the matter is we're talking about plays. I've always said that there are two functions of art. One is to educate and instruct, and the other two is to entertain, to bring joy, okay? And of course, in any dramatic enterprise, both of those are present. We go to a play, and if it's a great play, it will instruct and educate us. But it should also give us pleasure and should bring some joy to us. And indeed, even a very serious play, and often a very dark play, as much of the Oresteia is something that can be pleasurable because, again, what are we seeing? We're seeing before our eyes the acting out of something that is profound and that can lead us to better understand ourselves and the world in which we live. Great gift that this play gives us. But what we have in the Oresteia, and it's very interesting, is a play that comes at the dawn of what is called by theater historians one of the three golden ages of the drama. If you take a theater history course, or if you look at a theater history book, a textbook, it will take drama from the beginning, and indeed here we are at the beginning of drama, all the way up to modern theatrical productions. For almost all of recorded human history, human beings have acted things out. They have put on little plays. It's part of our heritage. It's part of what people have always done. But there are three ages that the theater historians call the three golden ages of drama. The first is the Greek theater in Athens in the 5th century BC. That's what we will be looking at tonight and tomorrow. That's the first of them. We then go ahead almost 1,000 years to Elizabethan England, the England of Shakespeare's day. And we have a great, great golden age that lasts from about 1580 until the theaters are closed by the Puritans in 1642. Okay? So again, it's limited in a way. The Greek theater, 5th century, probably, I'm going to say from about 480, maybe 480, up until Aristophanes dies in the 390 BCs, and that's the end of it. So again, maybe 100 years. The glory of the English theater from 1580 to 1642. And the third one, Spain in the Golden Age. The Golden Age of Spain, the 17th century, begins a little bit later than it did in England. It extends a little longer. It's hard to put exact beginning and dates on the Spanish Golden Age. The Spanish Golden Age is the least well-known one. The reason for that is prejudice against the Catholic Church. Theater historians have not explored, translated, given to the English-speaking world in general a knowledge of the glory of the Spanish Golden Age theater. I hope someday it happens. What is very interesting is that the Greeks produced great tragedy. The Elizabethans produced great tragedy. The Spanish Golden Age did not produce much tragedy. They produced great dramas, great comedies, wonderful theatrical plays, great allegories, religious plays, saints' plays, you name it. They produced everything, but they didn't produce great tragedy. There's something instructive there. And what it suggests to us is this, that the tragedy produced in the Golden Age of Greece and the tragedy produced in the Golden Age of Elizabethan England comes from doubt, uncertainty, worry, wonder, trying to figure out what exactly is the mystery of man, the relationship between humanity and the gods. It is a very, very complex subject, and the playwrights would go exploring. Now, obviously with the Greeks, they had not been given revelation. What had happened in Shakespeare's day, of course, is religious upheaval. Complete religious upheaval. There had been the terrible calamity of Henry VIII declaring himself the head of the church. There had been the calamity coming out of Europe with Luther. It was a time of religious upheaval, and as a result, even though we know for a fact, and if you don't know the great book by Eamon Duffy called The Stripping of the Altars, you might want to look at it. It's a wonderful history in which Duffy explains the Catholic faith was much more firmly rooted in England than most later historians pretended. They tended to suggest, the historians, that Henry VIII founded a new church and the English went along. It was not that simple. It was an enormous upheaval. And the Catholic practices and the Catholic faith remained rooted in many areas, and there were real contentions and conflicts that went on. Well, clearly, where is the place where contention and conflict can be explored? It's the drama, because the basis of drama is conflict, okay? And especially, if you're looking at conflict in religious terms, what do I believe? How can I know what I believe? What is there to believe? Who am I that I should believe? You end up with Hamlet, okay? That play that is a crux of doubt and trying to figure out, what does it all mean? What is going on? The Spanish did not have that problem. They were Catholic. They were devout. They had their plays. They're very good plays. They're very interesting plays. But they are unique. They're special. And they didn't produce great tragedy. They produced everything else. They're wonderful. It's the third golden age. Now, the first one we're going to look at is that first golden age of the drama. What defines a golden age? Why wasn't the age of the great Broadway musicals from about the late 1920s up until the 1960s? Why isn't that a golden age of the theater? There's a very simple reason. What the theater historians mean by a golden age is that the theater was the principal defining artistic element of the whole community. And that means, for Athens, the theater was central to the community. It wasn't just you go and get a ticket and you go to the show. Not at all. It grew out of religious ritual. I'll explain that in a moment. It grew out of religious ritual. Everyone attended. There was no question. When the festival of Dionysus occurred in Athens, everyone went to the theater. And what they saw was part religion and part art in a very strange mixture, and then it flowed back into the community. We'll see that at the end of the Oresteia. In the same way, in Shakespeare's day, everyone went to the theater. The theater was central. Now, obviously, Queen Elizabeth didn't go. But when she wanted to see a play, she ordered the players to the court, and they went there. So they went to her, but in the same way, she had to see the latest plays. Everyone knew what the latest plays were. And it wasn't just for entertainment's sake. It was how you defined yourself, the world you lived in, and what defined you as a community. And that was true for the Spanish in the 17th century as well. Everyone went to the theater. And we have an example. It's a stunning example. A religious allegory by the great Spanish playwright Calderón de la Barca called The Great Theater of the World. It's an allegory in which Calderón de la Barca looks at the various aspects of human life, what it means to be alive in the world, what the experience of living is like, with very interesting Catholic insights. And at the end of the play, the actors in the audience all go into the cathedral and go to Mass. The play ends with Mass. So that we quite literally have the theater, the community, and it ends with the Mass. That's a golden age. That's a golden age. The audience didn't file out of My Fair Lady and go to the local cathedral. Okay? And it's somehow almost unthinkable, okay? Wasn't a golden age. It was nice entertainment. Lovely songs, a very nice little story. It's very pleasant. Love the dances. But it's not a communal, artistic, religious experience where the very life of the city is defined by what's going on the stage. That's why it's a golden age, okay? Now, what's interesting again is that those golden ages were all intimately connected with religion. The connection between the theater and religion was extremely close, very intricate. I won't go into the history of either the English theater or the Spanish theater, but you can find it very easily. Both of those great moments of theater grew out of the Mass, grew out of worship, okay? It was there. But I'm going to look at some detail at how the theater came to be out of what the Greeks believed and indeed out of their worship. The great festival of Dionysus, as it was called, took place in Athens every spring. It was a spring festival. It was a festival of rebirth and renewal. It was a festival of resurrection, because the entire world of nature was coming back to life. Very interesting story. I'll pose it here. The reason that it was called the Festival of Dionysus, torn to pieces by his followers, goes into the ground and rises again in the spring. And of course, I would have very clever students who would raise their hands and say, well, it just shows all those religions are the same, and they all have the same mythic stories. And one calls it this, and another calls it that, but they're all the same, and it's all just myth. How would you answer it? It's a tough one. I'll give you the answer. I was able, after a couple of years of having become a traditional Catholic, to go kaboom. And it was always good to land one on a student, knock them back. I'll pose that question to you, and I'll answer it tomorrow. Fair enough? But they're just all the same. And you call it Christ, and the Greeks called it Dionysus, and it's just, you know. My Aunt Harriet is into, you know, worshiping her garden, and she worships her la-la plant that comes up in the spring, and it's all the same. Okay. It's a fair question. It comes up, okay? Well, the point is the Greeks had this notion. Their god who resurrected himself was Dionysus. and he resurrected himself in the springtime. And he was the god of fertility, obviously, because he rose in the spring, and he was the god of wine, the two things often intimately connected. So we've got the god of wine and the god of fertility. And therefore, it was an enormous spring festival, and as part of the celebration, the ritual, crowds would turn out and move through the streets of Athens, celebrating the resurrection of the god and singing hymns in his honor. And the hymns were called dithyrambs. Dithyrambs. Greek hymns sung in honor of the Greek gods. And on this occasion, the greatest festival of the year in Athens, they would go through the streets and sing dithyrambs. Now, obviously, there were the better singers had the principal role to play in the singing, and they would be led by certain religious leaders. And also, what would go on is that it would be a celebration not just of the return to life of the notion of Dionysus, but the plants, the renewal of the animals, the rebirth of everything. And as part of the celebration, many would wear animal skins. If you would, costumes. If any of you are from the Philadelphia area, know the Mummers Parade that takes place on New Year's, okay? This sort of thing still lasts. The big parade comes and you make costumes and you put on the costumes. They did that with the dithyrambs. But many of them were animal costumes, all right? And they would sing the dithyrambs. The singer who wore the goat costume would sing a very sad song. And the reason was, the legend went far back that the goat would take on himself the sorrows and pains and misfortune of the community and be driven out of the community, i.e. our word scapegoat. It still lingers in our language. The scapegoat is the one who ends up being blamed, who gets the burden of guilt. It goes all the way back here, so that the man, the singer, singing the dithyramb, wearing the goat costume, would sing a very sad song, and it came to be known as the Song of the Goat. The song, the Tra Gaudia. The Song of the Goat. See what we have? Tra Gaudia. And that's where we get our word tragedy. It's where the word tragedy comes from. The mournful casting off of the one individual who is somehow carrying the burden for the community, carrying the guilt of the community, being cast off. The second thing that happened was that you had an exchange that began between an individual voice, an individual singer, and the, if you will, group who was singing the dithyramb as well. Solo voice and chorus, okay? Much of this is legend. Cannot be proven, it's far back. But there are sources that suggest this. The man who stepped, if you will, out of the chorus and became the solo voice was supposedly a Greek named Thespis, from which we get the description of actors who have always been called thespians. And if you will, it was the solo voice. The solo voice beginning an exchange with the chorus, a back and forth. As you saw in the Agamemnon, it became incorporated, if you will, into the tragedy itself. The solo voice with the chorus, okay? All of this is going on. Now, how much time this takes, when it developed, we don't know for certain. But what happened was, they began to tell small stories. The exchanges began to partake of many of the Greek myths. Drama, as we know it, was born out of these religious rituals. And the festival of Dionysus incorporated as part of its worship a tragedy festival, a tragedy competition. And every year what would happen is there would be three writers chosen who would each write a three-part play, okay, based on some Greek myth. The three parts had to be linked. They had to be part of the same story. And the entire, as part of the celebration, the entire citizenry would go to the theater and watch this competition where playwright A, playwright B, playwright C each presented his trilogy, and then a winner would be announced for the year, and there was no higher honor you could attain in Athens than to be the winner of the tragedy competition connected with the Festival of Dionysus. It would sort of be like winning the Super Bowl, okay? And the community would rejoice forever and feel validated. I knew the Packers would win. I'm a citizen of Green Bay, and I am validated. I have a reason to live, and I can look down on every other team in the country. Of course, this is throwing pigskin around instead of singing the song of the goat, but you know, you choose your animals, you take your choice. By the way, I found it fair. This is very sad. I shouldn't be laughing. I found it very sad this year that the two teams in the Super Bowl were the Green Bay Packers and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Both teams named for industries that have shut down in both of their cities. You couldn't find a meat packer in Green Bay now any more than you could find a steel worker in Pittsburgh. It's just, well, but thank goodness they have football. I don't know. All right. So, it was a great competition. It was a great honor. And indeed, the first and most successful winner during all the years of the competition was Aeschylus. We think he was born in about 525 BC. Let me put the name up. It's one of those Greek names. We believe that he was born in about 525 BC. He came from something of a noble family, received a good education, and was there during the glory days when Athens acquired its sense of self. And one of the ways in which any community, state, or country comes to get a very real sense of self is by winning a great military victory. So that when the Persians invaded, and the great battle of the Athenians who were outnumbered against the Persians took place at Marathon, Aeschylus was fighting at that battle, and in fact performed very well, very honorably, and indeed when he died many years later, about 456 BC, he was in Sicily. An unusual death. He was an older man, he was honored, he was in Sicily. He was out walking in the fields and apparently sat down in the fields, and a hawk had a turtle, and the birds would break open the turtle shells by dropping them on rocks and then going and picking the innards. And the old bald man, as a bald man, this makes me very nervous. The old bald man was sitting out in the field, and apparently the bird thought it was a rock and dropped the turtle, and that was the end of Aeschylus. There's something Greek and fatalistic about it. In any case, when Aeschylus died, what he asked to be put on his tombstone was not that he had won all the competitions, although it was a great honor, or that he was honored for being a great poet and dramatist. It was that he had fought well at the Battle of Marathon. That was clearly his great pride. And in a sense, since that was what gave Athens its sense of definition, it makes sense. My father, God rest his soul, in his last years, kept reliving World War II. Kept reliving World War II, going back and talking about it. It was something that had given his life particular meaning, even though it happened 60 years earlier. And there are some who would say that in one sense, the glory days of America came at the end of that war with a sense of accomplishment and knowing who we were. Yeah, in any case, Marathon was enormous. And of course, you know this story. You must know this story. The news was of the victory was sent back to Athens. A single runner who had to run from the Battle of Marathon to Athens to say the Athenians had won. And that distance is the distance now used in all marathons. And that is where we get our word marathon. And that's why a marathon, I forget what it is. Maybe someone's actually run one. I don't know. In any case, that's why it's called a marathon. That's where it comes from. The messenger who ran from the Battle of Marathon to tell the Athenians they'd won. Now, only 10 years later, he fought again in the great naval battle at Salamis. King Xerxes came, another Persian invasion. They put them off again. So this, again, it was a great honor. And he fought well and had that sense of nobility. So he was much honored. He was much honored. We know that he wrote about 90 plays, okay? I'm not sure if that, I'm thinking that probably means 30 trilogies, okay? And we have the one. We have 7 individual plays, only the one trilogy, by Aeschylus. 7 out of 90. Let me run through the other 2 great tragedians. You can just put them down and so you'll have them all together. Aeschylus is the first, 525 to about 456 BC. We have 7 of his 90 plays. Next, Sophocles, who wrote Oedipus Rex, about 497 BC to 405 BC. So he spans that entire century. He wrote 120 plays. We have 7 of them. And finally, Euripides, born in 480 BC and died in 406. We have 18 of his 95 plays. So these playwrights were very prolific. By the way, I'll draw some distinctions among them in just a moment. You might ask, and it's a fair question, why do we only have a few of these? Answers are really very simple. Obviously, some were just lost over time. But the real tragedy was the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria, where probably most of them were housed. And when the Great Library was burned, they were lost. The fragments have been recovered, bits and pieces. We know what some of them were named, but it's a miracle in a sense that we have any of them at all. And as I said, the two that to me are most miraculous, that we have the Oresteia, this particular trilogy, the only trilogy we have, and that we have Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, which Aristotle in his Poetics calls the model tragedy. Aristotle thought that was the perfect model of what a tragedy should be. We're very lucky to have that. Let me draw some quick distinctions, and I'll do this very quickly. I'm behind already. I talk too much. Aeschylus. The best way to remember Aeschylus is he is a defender of the gods. He is explaining why the world works the way it does and how the plan of the gods is indeed beneficial to men. He is, if you will, that solid, upright, brilliant defender of the system as it is. This isn't to say there aren't doubts and questions, and he won't present a very serious drama, okay? We have 1/3 of his Prometheus trilogy called Prometheus Bound, where Prometheus spends most of the play railing against Zeus. What we've lost, and apparently it's what the rest of the play was coming to an understanding of why Zeus did what he did and some reconciliation between Prometheus and Zeus. We've lost that. We don't know. But you'll see very clearly in the Oresteia, we move from this horrific situation in the first play to indeed a healing and a great step forward at the end, okay? It's an astonishing movement. Sophocles begins to wrestle with doubts. He believes in the gods. He understands that there is such a thing as fate. But he's also trying to understand how human beings can then possess a measure of freedom. He is doubting. He's wrestling. And, if you will, dealing very seriously with very important issues. He does not possess the certainty that Aeschylus had. Doubts have come in. Euripides. Euripides was often unpopular in his day. Many Athenians believed that he didn't believe in the gods at all. What Euripides did believe in, and what he could convey brilliantly in his plays, was the power of human passion. And it's for that reason many of his greatest plays focus on women. Phaedron, the Hippolytus, Medea, the Trojan women. Because he's looking at human passions. And he has an extraordinary understanding of what motivates human beings, if you will. I don't like the word, but he's the most psychological of the three. He goes into the inner character and is looking at what drives humanity. Brilliant playwright, they're interesting plays. But there is a movement away from the certainty of Aeschylus to the doubt of Sophocles to the, if you will, inner workings of humanity in Euripides. And then, of course, comes Aristophanes, who just goes at everything. And the first great comic writer we have, that's another story for another time. He's a great, great writer. Now, all of this is going on. It's an extraordinary theatrical tradition. In the time remaining, what I want to do is give you some sense of the theater itself. Because the very building tells you much about what was going on in Athens, in the drama, and in the minds of the playwrights. Over time, what happened is they needed a place to do these plays, and there was a great theater built right at the foot of the Parthenon. One might say that, you know, the real glories of Athens. Certainly the philosophers that came later, but early on, that extraordinary piece of architecture, the Parthenon, I hope some of you have seen it, just staggering, and the Greek drama. Well, the drama was at the foot of the Parthenon, and one reason was it was very easy to go from the theater to the place of worship, or from the place of worship to the theater. The two were in the same neighborhood, if you will. It is very interesting to get to the Parthenon to worship. You climbed upward. The theater is down below. The great temple is up above. So one climbs upward to get to the temple to worship, but underneath it, there at the base of it, is the theater explaining to us, through our great playwrights, what is at the base of the worship that is then worshipped up above. Design-wise, it's brilliant. There's a reason for it. Now, what you had was the theater was built, and all the Greek theaters are this way. There is one great one that remains in Epidaurus. It's almost complete. Hour and a half outside of Athens. If you ever get a chance, visit it. They still do plays there. The acoustics are staggering. We don't yet understand how the Greeks had such perfect acoustics in their theaters. The guide, I saw it. The tour guide stood in the center of the theater. We were in the back row. And the tour guide just spoke in a simple voice, could hear it clearly. The acoustics are brilliant. A mystery. In any case, the seating was built into the hillside. So they would find a space, and we'd have many rows of seats around an open area. And this open area, and this is then the playing space. And by the way, the Agamemnon you saw did it nicely. The chorus remains in that space. That's the space for the chorus. They have a couple of entryways here. And this area where the chorus acts is called the orchestra. Sound familiar? The orchestra. It's the reason why it's still the bottom level of any theater. We're going to get orchestra seats, okay? We're all the way back at the Greeks. It means, if you will, the bottom level. But, and this is hugely important, in the center, the centerpiece was an altar. was an altar. So the chorus would come out and move around. They would play in this area. The great choral odes would be sung. It goes back to the dithyrambs. Not just recited. They would be sung. And the chorus would dance. Solemn, ritualistic dances. This isn't musical comedy. They're not singing Hello Dolly and kicking their legs, okay? This is solemn, ritual dance. And the choral odes would be sung, but they would move around the altar as they did it. I should have done this the other way around, okay? Well, that's okay. Then there was an enormous building here. If you will, the stage building proper, in the front of which enormous sets of double doors and a platform in front for the leading actors to walk on. You saw it again in the Agamemnon, those doors that open and close, and the playing area for the principal actors who will occasionally move down here, but only occasionally. They are, if you will, elevated a bit above the chorus. This building, think of it as a permanent set, and most of the playwrights would then set their plays in front of a palace, a temple, etc. It's a permanent, was called the scaena. So you had a permanent setting. The actors could come, but also in here in the back, you had a place for the actors to change costumes and a little resting place. So there was an offstage area, if you will, okay? This is the basic setup of the theater itself, but there's something very interesting here. And you saw it in the Agamemnon, and I'll talk about it again tomorrow. When the moment comes, and it is this incredible build up to the moment, the war in Troy ends. The watchman gets the signal. The chorus knows something has happened. Clytemnestra comes out of the palace. And they say, what has happened? She says, the war has ended. How do you know? And she describes the lights being sent from hilltop to... It's just magnificent stuff. We'll look at it tomorrow. I can't wait. I love it. The signal being sent from hilltop to hilltop. And that's how she knows. And now her husband is returning. And the chorus, the old men left behind who were too old to go to war. Glad I've reached that age now. The old men who have been left behind, don't have to go to war anymore, are very nervous. They know there's something going on in the palace. Agamemnon returns. He meets his wife. She rolls out those royal robes and says, why? He says, I can't. Why? She says, sure you can. He walks in, and the murder takes place inside. Okay? And then Cassandra sees her own future, sees what's going to happen, and she walks inside and she's killed. And then the doors swing open and the corpses come out. They would not present violence on the stage. It was considered inappropriate and uncivilized to look at violence taking place in public, even if it's not real, even if it's make-believe, even if it is, as Aristotle says, the imitation of an action, not an action itself, it's an imitation. The actors don't really die. Nevertheless, you do not show violence in public. It is so horrific. The spilling of blood is something that is sacred, and you don't just toy with it in a play by putting it out there on the stage. Because who knows what it might do to those who are observing it? For that reason, all violence had to take place away from the scaena, or the Greek, away, ab. Ab scaena, away from the scaena, from which we get our word obscene. Away from the scene, that which should not be viewed by civilized human beings is obscene and should take place off stage. This is what I mean by these were a very civilized people. A very civilized people. I can no longer go to the movies. The blood that flows is nauseating. Nauseating. The movement from the Greeks to the Romans, the Romans took all these plays, wrote bad versions of them, and let the blood flow. They loved it. They lapped it up. It is a sign of a decline in civilized culture. Let me give you an example. Euripides' great play, Hippolytus. Phaedra falls in love with her stepson. She's married to Theseus. And he is a young man of great purity. She makes advances on him. He's horrified. He rejects her. She hangs herself and leaves a note telling her husband that the stepson has violated her as a woman. The father is horrified, seeks to kill his own son. Hippolytus flees, rides off in a chariot. A great bull comes out of the sea and attacks the chariot, and Hippolytus is trampled to death by his horses. A messenger comes and tells the father what has happened, and the father realizes his wife lied, the son was innocent, he's lost his son. It's a great play, very moving. It's a great play. In the Roman version, by the Roman tragedian Seneca, at the end of the play is going along in the same way, word doesn't come from the messenger of what happened out there. The messenger brings in the body parts. And the play ends with Theseus trying to reassemble his son like he's putting a jigsaw puzzle together. That's Roman. That's Roman. Euripides would have been horrified. Absolutely horrified, okay? Because Agamemnon and Cassandra are killed off stage. Jocasta and Oedipus hangs herself off stage. Oedipus blinds himself off stage. Hippolytus dies by the seashore, far away. We get the report of it. The Greeks did not watch violence on stage. They wouldn't have been able to sit through 30 seconds of a modern Hollywood horror film. Okay? The Romans would have bought extra tickets and brought their friends. I will just make one point, and this is something very, very strange. In that movement of civilization from the Athenians, who had a strong religious base, were fascinated with drama and poetry, and produced great philosophers, we go to Rome, that is the country of politics and engineering. And it had to be part of God's design, because they, being great engineers, spread Rome to the world and built all those roads and the aqueducts, so that when the most important message had to go out into the world, the engineering feats were there to at least begin to make it possible. God has his reasons. But I would say this, I find it very odd, that this society, the Romans, obsessed with politics and engineering, needed blood. And it's one of the things that makes me very uneasy about our own politically obsessed country, magnificent engineering feats, and boy, we love those bloody movies. Or seeing those football players carried off the field, or the hockey players losing their teeth when they get the hockey stick right in the mouth. I don't know. The Greeks would have been horrified. I'm speaking in praise of the Greeks at their greatest. Okay. In any case, that's what was going on. An extraordinary time that produced very, very great art. Movies, or seeing those football players carried off the field, or the hockey players losing their teeth when they get the hockey stick right in the mouth. I don't know. The Greeks would have been horrified. I'm speaking in praise of the Greeks at their greatest. Okay. In any case, that's what was going on. An extraordinary time that produced very, very great art. I'll tell you, I was going to add one thing tonight. I'll save it till tomorrow and give you the background for Agamemnon, but there really isn't time now. I've talked too much. So what I'll do is take questions if there are any, and then we'll pick up with the full play. Tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to talk about the Agamemnon, and tomorrow night, the Libation Bearers and the Eumenides. So that's what's coming tomorrow. I'm actually made it to the play, sort of, tonight, so that's good. I rarely get to cover anything I intend to cover at all. So I guess I'm fairly pleased. Anybody have any questions? I'd be happy to answer. So, yes.
Dr. White, what should we think about the violence that occurs in the Shakespearean plays?
Interesting. The question. I'll repeat the question just for the wonderful hanging microphones. I complain about technology, but I'm glad I don't have to be hooked up and have this thing in my pocket and worry that I'm going to pull the cord or anything. So anyway, what do we think about the violence in the Shakespeare plays? What happened was, and it's very interesting, the model for writing tragedy that Shakespeare knew came from the Romans. He would not really have known the Greek plays, but he would have known the plays of Seneca. The drama that would have been studied, and it would have, even in his little grammar school in Stratford, he would have studied the great Roman comedians Plautus and Terence, and indeed he rewrites one of Plautus's comedies in both Comedy of Errors and Twelfth Night, and he would have read Seneca, who was Seneca, the great Roman tragedian, where the blood flowed. So in his model for what tragedy should be, it is bloody, which is why his first tragedy is just appallingly bloody. It's called Titus Andronicus, written early in his career, very popular, one of the things that made his career. I can't begin to list all the horrors that are in that play. But the fact, I saw a production once where at intermission, the stage crew had to come out and mop up the fake blood. There was so much on the stage. That's the tradition he was writing out of. I'll say this to his credit. As he matured as a dramatist, he uses it more sparingly and then always uses it for dramatic impact at a moment where it connects with the ideas of the play. But when it was a hotshot young playwright, it was just, you know, let her rip, and its tongue's bitten out and the hands lopped off, and it's just horrible. I knew an actress up at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Canada. She was playing Lavinia in Titus Andronicus, the heroine. Poor thing. Loses her tongue, gets both hands cut off. It's just awful. And but I had some other friends who were going to visit her. It was during the rehearsal period. The friends arrived late at night. She was in bed. She left a note saying, you know, I'm in bed, but, you know, your room is here. And here are the towels. And, you know, so everything was set. And that next morning, she had to get up early to go to the theater and hadn't even seen the friends that had arrived. So she shouted up the stairs and said, I have to leave now. I put the coffee on, and there's cereal and milk, and there's toast, so help yourselves. I'll be back in a little bit. I have to go to the theater and be measured for my stumps. I mean, she... The friends told me they woke up, and that's what they heard, you know, saying, What are they doing then? Oh, that's right. She's playing Lavinia in Titus Andronicus. Loses both hands. And then her tongue walks around with stumps and going, it's just awful. Just an embarrassment. T.S. Eliot called it the worst play in the English language. But you know what's very interesting? What's very interesting is in the great elegy written for Shakespeare after his death by his friendly rival Ben Jonson, Johnson talks about Shakespeare being a great comic writer who rivaled Plautus and Terence, the great, and they were wonderful comic writers. Rome could do comedy. But then says, and a great tragedian, and I don't invoke the name Seneca, but one who could walk the boards with Aeschylus and Sophocles. And Johnson was a great scholar, would have known Greek, probably had some access and would have read those plays. And he compares the greatness of Shakespeare to the greatness of the Greeks. A very, very high compliment. And as I say, it must have been, it's in that great, if you don't know the poem, check it out sometime, to the memory of Master William Shakespeare. It's one of the great elegies, and it must have killed Johnson to write it. They were rivals, they were friends, but, you know, rivals the whole time. And Johnson was always critical of Shakespeare, and then Shakespeare's gone, he writes this beautiful tribute, and it's in there. The line appears for the first time. He was not of an age, but for all time. And Johnson knew it and had to admit it, and did admit it publicly. Must have killed him. He was better. I'm second best. It's just... I'll tell one last story and then I'll stop. The last play that George Bernard Shaw wrote is a puppet show called Shakes versus Shave. And Shaw had a lifelong battle with Shakespeare because Shaw knew he was always going to be considered the second greatest English playwright. And it annoyed him. And so it comes to the end. The last play writes a little puppet play. And there's a Shakespeare puppet and a Shaw puppet. And they're sort of saying, the Shaw puppet's very humble and very sweet. And the Shakespeare puppet is arrogant and proud of himself and very obnoxious. So they decide at first to have a little boxing match. And of course, the Shakespeare puppet doesn't fight fair at all and is hitting low blows and it's just terrible. So they can't decide the contest that way. So they decide they will present their good work and see who wrote the best plays. So Shaw is conjuring up Pygmalion and his Heartbreak House, and Shakespeare's conjuring up his great plays. And so they finally decide, well, we can't decide it that way, so what do we do? And the Shaw puppet finally brings out a little candle and sets it there and says, all right, I'll admit it. Here at the close, he was like 93 when he wrote this, here at the close, I'll admit it, you're greater than I am. You're the greatest playwright in the English language. But please allow my little candle to shine for a while. And the Shakespeare puppet says, out, out, brief candle. And the final scene direction is, the scene dissolves in darkness. See, I wound up telling jokes anyway. I can't help it. We'll talk about Agamemnon tomorrow afternoon. 3:30, I believe, yes? Or 3? 3. Check the board. I will.